speakers. This has been a wonderful conference. So I'm going to discuss some work that we're finishing up with Adams, McGreevy, and a couple of students, Liu and Saltman. So it has to do with a very basic question about gravity, namely whether space-time topology can change dynamically. So two cartoon prototypes for this could be some space changing its topological invariant, such as its Euler character, or even separating into different components, changing its most basic topological invariant, B naught. Now, in classical GR, this would be singular. It would require ripping the space and is therefore of unclear status just in the context of general relativity. But in quantum gravity, or even classical but stringy gravity, there is a possibility that something more interesting could happen, in that general relativity and with it ordinary geometry breaks down. So there's room for topology change to happen in a physically smooth and consistent way. There are a bunch of previous examples. Just a few are listed here. Flops, some change in Euler character in 0-2 models, conifold transitions, chirality changing transitions, what are called flips, which happen in more generic singular geometries, orbifold geometries in string theory, as well as earlier work on Euclidean quantum gravity suggesting the possibility of so-called baby universe formation. And there's a long and illustrious list of contributions to that fascinating but rather confusing subject. What I'm going to tell you in a nutshell is that we find a very simple case of a topology changing process in string theory, which involves in particular a change in the Euler character of the bulk geometry of the space-time target space, as well as separation of space into different components, which you might call baby universe formation, but here it's not necessarily a baby. And all of the above happens via a mechanism that appears perturbatively in string theory via stringy effects to do with the extent of the string. So the setting for this is compactification. Let's say for simplicity, we start in 10-dimensional superstring theory. And we'll consider compactification on Riemann surface, as depicted here, with genus H, which means H handles. Its topology is characterized by, well, first of all, the number of connected components, the genus that I just mentioned, and in theories with fermions, it's important to also keep track of the spin structure of those fermions, the boundary conditions of fermions around the various non-trivial one cycles in this space. So let's get our bearings by studying this system in the GR approximation first. So in that approximation, which is valid when all length scales are much bigger than the string length scale, it's the geometry of the space is characterized modding out by diffeomorphisms by the following quantities. We can boil down the metric using diffeomorphisms to a conformal factor times some fiducial metric. As I'll explain, the constant curvature metric is a particularly natural one. This conformal factor's lowest mode is the volume, the radian mode, if you like, of the Riemann surface. And these parameters tau, which are just numbers, not functions of position, just numbers, are the 3H minus 3 complex structure moduli that remain in describing the geometry of the surface after modding by diffeomorphisms. So these determine intuitively the ratios of sizes of the various one cycles in the manifold. And these also determine how far we are from factorization limits where the surface approaches a pair of separate ones. Okay, so if we consider string theory or really any higher dimensional gravity theory, compactified on this space. Let's say we do string theory going from 10 to 8 on some Riemann surface, then the if we consider first the constant curvature metric, the resulting potential energy in 8 dimensions, the moduli potential that results from the 10-dimensional Einstein term, is what I've written here. It depends on the string coupling in the way that I expressed here. In particular, this first factor is coming from the fact that the integral of the curvature over a Riemann surface gives the Euler character, where in tree level, which means in the string frame, there would be a 1 over g string squared in front of this thing. And then we convert to Einstein frame by this factor, g squared over v to the 4/3. OK, so as with all forms of energy, it dilutes at large volume and weak coupling, as you can see from this formula. And this formula also shows, given the sign, which follows from the negative curvature of the space, that in the absence of other sources, this space is time dependent. It evolves toward a larger volume and weaker coupling. If we didn't consider the constant curvature metric, then volume element by volume element, a similar dynamics obtains, and the system would evolve toward the constant curvature metric because regions of positive curvature shrink by the equations of motion, and regions of negative curvature expand, and so the system equilibrates toward the constant curvature metric, and you can keep that in mind as a well-motivated configuration from here on out as a result of that. Now, the last and, for this purpose, most important thing I want you to notice about this formula is that it also shows that the potential energy decreases if the number of handles decreases. So that means, at least naively, that if the system can reduce the number of handles, it is energetically preferred for it to do so, and it will happen if there's some pathway for that. Okay. So in other work with my student Saltman, we showed that you can add additional ingredients to this setup. One can compactify on a product of 3 Riemann surfaces with some brains, effective Oriental folds, and fluxes to perturbatively metastabilize the complex structure moduli, the volumes of these surfaces, and the string coupling to obtain a large class of 4-dimensional de Sitter models, which are well controlled in the perturbation expansion, both in G string and in alpha prime times all the flux and curvature quantum numbers in the system. So here, what we're going to do is study another regime without such stabilizing ingredients, and we'll find some topology-changing dynamics of the sort I was motivating earlier, in particular realizing this possibility of losing handles and possibility of splitting the surface in two. I want to emphasize, though, that these considerations are somewhat orthogonal to this model building exercise we had done earlier, which, as far as we know, still suffices to metastabilize the solutions. One more just general mark before I continue with the details. This is a very sophisticated audience, so it's probably not necessary, but let me just say this. So as you know, people often consider Calabi-Yau compactifications, or their SUSY cousins by various dualities or extensions. And this is a fascinating subject and has taught us a lot, but it's not required either for consistency, control, or phenomenology, even if you want supersymmetry in the matter sector at low energies. So I think in some discussions at least, the logic leading to this condition, which most technically is sometimes imposed as a way to ensure canceling tadpoles classically, it's really not a logical thing to do once you want to include the dynamics of the moduli and fix them, because if you include tree-level contributions to the moduli potential, such as the one I reviewed here, then that provides a tree level of force that helps fix the moduli, as opposed to insisting that all tadpoles are canceled perturbatively, which then requires some more subtle non-perturbative effects to fix the moduli. In other words, the inclined plane problem is a perfectly consistent background for string theory. Okay, so let me now continue with the main thread. As I said before, in general, when all length scales are bigger than string scale, classical geometry applies, and the number of handles, for example, will not change perturbatively. However, as I said again generally, it may be possible to go through some string scale regime where these notions break down, and then come out to large radius to a geometrical phase again with some different topology. Now, in this context of Riemann surfaces, there are two natural two places where we'll find such dynamics. And they're both this involve the same physics locally. So the two regions I have in mind are as follows. Consider the Riemann surface, move in complex structure moduli space toward a place where a handle is getting thin and long while retaining a flat, low curvature, to good approximation. We can take we can consider a regime where a handle is getting very long and thin. We are not going to go literally to a place where this handle goes to zero size. That would be an infinite distance degeneration of the surface. But what we'll require is rolling toward the regime where this handle circumference that I've drawn is less than the string length scale. Yes?
Talk about the classical potential. So since that's driving you to large volume at the same time, say rolling off to sort of smaller handles, conformally speaking, what is classically the typical thing that happens? Are you making a long finite size handle, or really one that is pinching down to zero?
Well, the thing is, at the classical level, the complex structure moduli are exactly flat.
Oh, okay.
So let me actually comment on that right now. So if you consider the first perturbative correction to see what happens at leading non-trivial order to the complex moduli, they in fact do exactly this. There's a Casimir energy which forces the handles to shrink. So
okay, but at the same time, the overall volume is growing.
Well, you can set it up starting with a locally flat region consistently. The places where the curvature is negative grow faster, and that flat region, by virtue of the complex structure potential energy generated at the next order, shrinks consistently. Yeah. So what we'll want here is to maintain, indeed, that the curvatures are always weak, so that although there is this time dependence, it's very, very mild, while we'll be interested in the stringy effects to do with this handle that, as you'll see, can occur much faster. So there will be an independent time scale associated with the process I'm going to talk about that beats this mild time dependence that is introduced by the curvature. So the second version of this involves also a small thin tube, but one in this kind of configuration where it's separating two sides of the surface. So in both of these situations, because they're similar locally, winding modes, stringy contributions to the spectrum coming from strings winding around this thin tube, can become light and make a big impact on the dynamics. In particular, if we have anti-periodic boundary conditions for any space-time fermions around those tubes, then there is what's known as a Schirk-Schwarz tachyon that appears in the spectrum for the specifications I made that the size is below this string scale value. Because if you look at the zero-point energy in you can think about it most simply in terms of Green-Schwarz. There's anti-periodic boundary conditions for the Green-Schwarz fermions, which yields a minus 1/2 contribution to the world sheet vacuum energy. Added to that, the winding energy yields this mass formula, which, as you can see, then becomes tachyonic for a sufficiently small radius. Okay, so what about these boundary conditions? Well, in the case of the small handle, they depend on your choice of spin structure. And to study this particular process we'll be interested in, we will simply choose the spin structure so that you have this antiperiodic boundary condition. In this other case of near factorization, basically because this is a trivial cycle, it automatically has antiperiodic boundary conditions for fermions. You can think about this in physics language from the fact, of course, this thing is a space-time target space component for us, but if for 1 second you think about what you know about world sheet physics, where similar pictures pertain, in a vacuum diagram like this, the boundary conditions around this cycle are indeed antiperiodic for fermions and as sector states that propagate in that tube. Okay, so we have this tachyon. It will condense. Question is, what happens? Now, in general, on general grounds, it's been argued for a long time that condensation of tachyons should reduce the number of degrees of freedom in the region where that process occurs. Basic idea is that in the language of the string world sheet calculations, the vertex operator for the tachyon is some relevant operator from the matter sector times the time dependence from the gravity or non-unitary part of coming from the time direction. And it looks like a growing coupling times a relevant operator, suggesting very strongly that the matter central charge in this string theory decreases given the Zamolodchikov-C theorem and the basic intuition that condensing relevant operators reduces the number of degrees of freedom. So this is the general idea. There are several very well-studied examples where this is borne out in detail, including the open-string brain-antibrain tachyons that appear in twisted sectors of generic non-supersymmetric orbifolds. And in all cases, the number of degrees of freedom decrease, as you would expect. Though in the case of localized tachyons, one has to be careful about considering the bulk versus the localized contribution.
So in your case, it's going to happen, can we be in eight-dimensional
space-time? Or is this well, right. So you could ask that question in two senses. One is, can we set it up to happen? As you know, and the other is, what is natural in cosmology? So in order for this to happen, if you start at some generic place, you've got to roll in complex structure moduli space toward this position, which is, as I explained, in the absence of other ingredients, natural by the one-loop tadpole anyway. But it's certainly true that, and then once you're in that region, the tachyon is there everywhere, that the complex structure moduli is in the right position. So at that point, there's no natural way to stop it from happening everywhere that that's true. But you could imagine that the complex structure modulus has some kibble sort of configuration where, you know, it only takes it where it varies according to horizon volume or something. We're still in the process of thinking about cosmological scenarios involving this, but the basic mechanism is what I want to focus on here. But just, what I'm trying to say is, it's natural to have these handles. It's natural for them to roll toward this direction. And so on the face of it, it looks not very tuned to obtain this physics. Okay, so now, as I'm going to explain in our case, there's very strong evidence that this also occurs, which we're going to develop further and apply to topology change, as I indicated. So let's just look at this local region of this tube that's becoming thin somewhere. It's useful to think about both this situation coordinatized by theta and r, as I've drawn, and its t-dual version coordinatized by the dual angle theta tilde and r. Let's consider type 2 string theory for specificity. The tachyon vertex operator is then in 1, 1 superspace. The integral over superspace of some potential t of x in terms of superspace coordinates, big R and big theta tilde, which for a winding mode is a sinusoidal dependence on theta tilde. and combined with dependence on R that follows from the fact that the tachyon is localized in this region by a mild dependence on this radial or lengthwise coordinate R, and then the corresponding exponentially growing time dependence appears also there as indicated. Now what we'll do, which is also natural, is let the tachyon start rolling as soon as it starts to appear, which will involve both the R and the kappa dependence to be rather weaker than the theta tilde dependence here. And this will give us some technical advantages, though the results won't really depend on that. Yeah?
Just a question about the dynamics.
Yeah.
For this particular calculation, you're sort of assuming that the change in shape of the tube is sufficiently slow so that you treat this as rapid, this process that you're about to calculate as rapid compared to that?
That's right.
Is that actually true, or is that?
Yeah, because as soon as you start shrinking below the string scale, say you go to, you know, half the string scale or something, then the time scale involved in this decay is you know, order some fraction of the string scale, whereas the curvature expansion that we set up is as mild as you want it to be.
Or actually, not the shrinking, the radius.
Oh, you mean the
I'm not worried about the Calabi outline. I'm just worried about locally. The tube is shrinking down. The tachyon comes in, but you might have thought that, you know, instead of a, we've got a tachyonic direction this way, but you're coming in this way, right? So you might have thought that it takes a while for the system to discover its tachyon.
Well, actually, what happens is moduli trapping and parametric resonance actually trap you there really fast. I'll comment on that later. It's a version of hybrid inflation, really, that's kind of stringy. Okay, so when we condense the tachyon, that is adding this operator to the Wolgsheed action, then the Wolgsheed Lagrangian is of the following form. There's a kinetic term and there's a potential term following from this superspace interaction, which has the following terms that I've indicated with for the specifications I made, namely having, because of the curvature and the choice of tachyonic R dependence we make, the momentum scale and the R dependence and the time scale is parametrically smaller than this winding momentum scale that appears in the basic leading contribution coming from differentiating this potential with respect to theta tilde. So there's an interesting negative piece, which is interpreted as coming from Wolgsheed supergravity, just as in familiar higher dimensional supergravities that arises. And because of these inequalities, we can, to get approximation, focus first on this strongest term in terms of the effect of this process on the theta tilde sector. So I'm going to start with that. Okay, so because of that mild variation in the other directions, we'll focus on the theta tilde sector first, and in particular that strongest term that I just showed. This is a very good approximation for energies lower than the mass scale in the theta tilde sector, which we'll find is substantial. So in this time-dependent problem that we set up, the physical problem of dynamical topology change, this question of how that theta sector theory behaves in the infrared applies directly in the sense that I just explained. Independently of that, people often study the renormalization group flow in the matter sector in its own right, with the motivation that this is likely to reflect the off-shell string configuration space, as argued, for example, early on by these authors, and as I said before, applied successfully to other tachyon condensation problems. So for both these reasons, let me now turn to the study of the renormalization group flow of the theta sector from this Lagrangian, dominated by that term, as we go to the physical IR limit. Well, this theory is well known. It has many names. The supersymmetric Sine-Gordon model. It's related to the XY model, the continuum limit of the XY model, and the Coster-Lostalis system. So the situation is that classically we have the sinusoidal potential, and that gives evident masses to the elementary fields, as well as the solid-atomic kink solutions. Quantum mechanics, we need to study this in the deep IR, where quantum mechanics obviously matters. And for the entire system, there are strong arguments for this mass gap surviving. First of all, in the bosonic version of this, this is the Coster-Lostalis transition. We're condensing vortices, and we expect them to destroy long-range order in the way that Coster-Lostalis explained. Furthermore, this theory is integrable, and there are proposed exact S-matrix solutions to those constraints by Schenker, Witten, Ahn, and more recently studied by people like Hollowood, all of which agree that there is a mass gap, that the mass is, in our language, proportional to this tachyon, VeV. Finally, you can even argue by a process of elimination. We're starting in the theta tilde sector by itself with a C equals 3 halves and equals 1 theory, and if you go below that, which you clearly do by initially condensing the tachyon, there's a classification of the possible dimensions that come out in such highly constrained lower central charge CFTs. And again, I think there's not an absolute proof, but there's a huge amount of evidence that there's no such model without relevant operators. So because of all these reasons, which are very standard, I'm going to grant that this supersymmetric Sine-Gordon model has a mass gap. So that means in our context that this RG flow removes the theta direction in the region of the tube, the region in R, little r space, where it was thin, where the tachyon condensed. Once that's true, the theory has gone subcritical and automatically has further tachyons, which condense and further remove degrees of freedom. We can be even more specific about it, but that's now clear. So let's study that explicitly in the model that we have. So we've now established that even quantum mechanically, the theta sector is frozen in its vacuum in the IR by this mass gap. So put it there, put it in its vacuum, and look at the rest of the dynamics for the other modes. In particular, continuing in this RG study, let's next look at the matter field R. Well, if you do this, then you find that the potential for R remains after this procedure. In particular, there's a potential barrier that's growing for the string in this region. This potential barrier repels all modes of energy less than this supersymmetric Sine-Gordon mass, which is proportional to the tachyon VeV T in the coordinates we started with. So given this, we conclude that the space in the region where the tachyon condensed has disappeared, which implies that there has been a topology-changing process that I advertised. Now, okay, let me say one more thing about this before I answer your question. There's these mysterious dots that I have also drawn on these pictures that corresponds to the fact that at the classical level, there is a Witten index argument that requires it to be conserved. And we find quite explicitly using techniques I'm about to show that indeed there are extra massive vacua which provide the necessary residual contributions to trace -1 to the F in this context. So also from this potential energy, you see extra vacua developing, and those, again, correspond to subcritical sectors, which I'll refer to as subcritical dust for lack of a better name. Okay, question?
So actually, two things. One is, I guess I'd like to better understand why you think the space actually breaks, as opposed to, say, still being connected, but having a growing potential there. Those are different things, right?
Oh, because the you get a mass gap. It's not.
Not for motion in the r direction. That's what I'm wondering about.
No, you do. So I explained it for the supersymmetric Klein-Gordon theory, and then I pointed out that you still have tachyons in the r direction. I also showed that, in the R theory, it's a subcritical theory, there are tachyons, and those continue. Yeah, and I mean, again, this R direction is a C equals 3/2 theory. There's nothing else it can really do. I'll actually show this in a different way that is, you know, more democratic between theta and R in a second. We did consider the possibility that this thing sort of hangs by a thread in the way that you were just describing, but that is contraindicated by the presence of tachyons in that remaining putative thread. So let me make a few more remarks on these details. I guess I was just saying this verbally or orally. Classically, the Witten index is preserved, and this better be there, and we find indeed that it is in the presence of these extra vacua. In fact, the nicest way to see that, which was also applied to earlier tachyon problems, such as the C mod Zn type problems, most closely to this analysis by Vaffa, is to realize this system as the infrared limit of some simpler linear sigma model that flows to the system of interest in the IR. So I won't go through all the details of the construction of this model because it requires a lot of notation and such, but I think I can summarize for you the salient features. This will be especially useful for those who have thought about Witten's linear sigma model description of Calabi-Yau compactifications or Vaffa's linear sigma model analysis of the C mod Zn flows. Okay, so one can consider a linear sigma model whose potential energy, depending on some coordinates W and complex coordinate phi, includes a piece of the form I've written, that the potential energy, the vacuum manifold of this model, is described by the setting to zero this particular quantity in terms of ordinary linear sigma models. This comes from a D-term constraint. Okay, so this geometry, which we get out of a well-defined linear sigma model, describes, as you change this parameter rho from something negative to something positive, a transition from this geometry, which you can see from this equation follows for negative rho from the fact that this complex phi variable has to be bigger than rho, so it never shrinks below that minimal value, whereas when rho is positive, phi can shrink and does so in these two places, while this real coordinate W is always bounded to be bigger than something of order square root of rho. So trivially, this equation describes a geometry changing as you change this parameter rho from this picture to that picture, with extra vacua coming from this field sigma that appears in the superspace version of it. I'm just sketching this out. The details aren't supposed to be clear, but the general gist of it, I hope, is. Furthermore, one can show that this parameter rho is a relevant parameter coupling that indeed flows in this direction from negative to positive. One can also show that in the context of these linear models, this parameter rho multiplies winding operators using the Hori-Vaffa duality, for example, which really is the Buescher duality in this more general context. So to summarize this part, just using a gauge linear sigma model description, we can study the whole geometry, the R direction, the theta direction, at the same time, and we do see this disconnect arise in that type of setup. It's a little bit more complicated than the usual cases people might be familiar with, because this tachyon is not n equals 2 preserving, so we do a kind of softly broken n equals 2 to n equals 1 description. Anyway, this will all be in a long appendix of the paper. Okay. So now let me talk about some more of the implications of this, the generalizations. So as with other tachyon decay problems, there is an interesting spectrum of charges that as we lose the degrees of freedom corresponding to the tachyon flow, there are charges that disappear in that process, and it's interesting to understand how that works. So in particular, in this context, we have this handle decaying. Let's do that case, because that handle has non-trivial cycles associated with it, which are decaying away. So in particular, the string winding charges that I've drawn here on the what's called A and dual B cycles are disappearing in this process. So how does that work? Well, it works the same as in all the other cases we're familiar with. Because the tachyon is a winding operator, it manifestly Higgs is the gauge field corresponding to the A cycle. Well, if you consider the kinetic energy term for FA and FB, you get a result that exhibits a strong coupling developing for FB in this process, and it appears, therefore, to confine, although, as always, that is a more complicated thing to describe explicitly. We can also add fluxes that are mild enough to allow us to reach this interesting regime, as opposed to the ones that metastabilize it far away. And we can incorporate that into this process in a pretty trivial way. Namely, if we do add such mild fluxes that still allow the thing to shrink, then this process can still occur consistently with the production of a brain-antibrain pair on which the flux can then end as the thing caps off. And those can then later annihilate if they find each other. Okay, so now let's get into the subject of how this really works when the string coupling is on, and so on. So as I explained, we have to roll in complex structure moduli space toward the region where the tube is thin. That's natural given the direction of the forces in the problem. Then we condense the tachyon, and there's this liberated potential energy that can and will convert into all sorts of stuff. Now let me actually say something important about the scales in the problem that I showed implicitly earlier, but it's important for this discussion. So if we go back to look at the potential energy that's now being liberated as we do decay away this handle, you can see that relative to the Planck energy density, it is suppressed if the string coupling is small. So this is not a situation which produces a black brain in terms of its decay products, but still, as with the brains and antibrains, there will be a large amount of particle and string production, and all indications are that will rapidly liberate this potential energy into all that stuff. Getting back to Matt's question, this dynamics is very similar to what we know about hybrid inflation. And there, as Kaufman, Linde, and Starobinsky showed so beautifully, as one rolls in this language, as one rolls in tau toward this region, the fact that the tachyon mass is changing means, as is true generally, that particle production will occur of that tachyon. And if the system tried to roll past where it was getting light, it would bring it back, because once you produce these tachyons, they have some number density. Their energy density is then their mass times that number density. And if they try to roll past, there's a linear potential that drives them back. So it naturally gets trapped here, and then once it's there, it condenses. Mark.
I guess you mentioned at some point this sort of T-dual picture. How should I think about this in that? What actually happens?
It also gets singular, and string theory becomes important, and it's, it's again, abstractly, the renormalization group flow of this supersymmetric Sine-Gordon theory. I can't give it a geometrical way to see it, of course. I certainly can't give you a blow-by-blow analysis of exactly what happens as it rolls, but neither could we in brains and not their brains, so I think it's roughly on the same footing. So the same kinds of computations that suggest droplet particle production and so on are present here, but the same limitations on our ability to really follow it in detail are also there. So I can't answer that, but it's not, you wouldn't expect a geometrical description. Okay, so now actually there's something fun about this, which is that actually this process here, for trivial reasons, occurs much more efficiently than in, say, conifold transition. And the reason is that there, this moduli trapping effect that I just mentioned also occurs, but it just stops you at the intersection of the two branches in the conifold transition, as opposed to letting the system proceed through and see the new large radius different topology geometry. Okay, so I guess I already said this part. Now, obviously, this case, which you might think of as baby universes, or in this case, just more general disconnection of different parts of the bulk geometry, is obviously the most striking and perhaps troubling aspect of these results. And here, it's happening by what's essentially a perturbative mechanism. And you notice that in this discussion, I had no need to debate the sign of the Euclidean quantum gravity action or the other considerations that go into the earlier attempts to control this question of baby universes in quantum gravity. Now, sorry.
Well, a comment. Well, that sign I don't think was a critical snafu for earlier discussions of semi-classical processes. It was an issue when one was thinking about trying to zero the cosmological constant.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying it's not a criticism. It's very confusing, but it's pretty difficult if you don't agree on 120 orders of magnitude in the exponent. It's
well, yeah, that's down the line when you try to get the measure of coupling constants. That's the end of the story. But just having say some instantons that describe branching of the universe, it's semi-classical equations. That is something that doesn't depend on knowing about the sign.
It doesn't depend on knowing about the action for the process.
Certainly you have. Yeah, but. There's not an issue of, how should I put it? The funny business of the sign is in the controllable mode.
Right.
And you may worry about that when you look at fluctuations and so on, but you can get the action for these instantons, and it's a suppressed tunneling and so on. And I think that all makes sense.
The
sign comes in other things. Comes in looking at fluctuations around the instanton, and comes in looking at this old argument that the cosmological constant could be set to zero by this distribution of baby universes.
Okay, but there are some instantons in this subject that really, whose basic action depended on this ambiguity, like the Hawking-Moss process and so on. But okay. It may be different for the wormhole stuff. Okay, I'll take a look at that. Anyway, my point is just that here it's happening perturbatively by a stringy mechanism that's rather different from those considered earlier and seems to therefore motivate in a renewed way the need to really make sense of this kind of thing. So we're, of course, then led to have to worry about this causal disconnection between the two components. It raises obvious questions about pure states here, then seeming to evolve to mixed states, and so on. And of course, these are in some ways similar issues in the de Sitter discretium and so on, as Andreas discussed in his talk. So there's a sense in which this ship has already sailed and some of us are on it, but here it's different microscopically. It involves actual separation of spatial components and so on, so it's also rather different than any case yet considered that I know of. Okay, so anyway, since this is a rather strong statement, let me just make sure I've made clear where it comes from and also list some conceivable loopholes, although we find them extremely implausible. So one is, there's not an absolute mathematical proof that there's a mass gap in the supersymmetric Sine-Gordon theory. It seems to fall out of every analysis that's been done. But okay, that's one conceivable way out. We also didn't establish explicitly that the process occurs in finite time, according to an appropriate observer to that question. But this aspect is no different from any of the other cases, brains, anti-brains, et cetera, where, again, you see large particle production, a mechanism for energy transfer, with no evident converse slowing down mechanism available. So, but let me just mention it as a logical possibility. Okay, so anytime one finds a new phenomenon, it's useful to at least make an attempt to see if this can be connected to something literally observable. So it's interesting to think about this in the context, say, of early universe cosmology, or maybe even if we're lucky to see some low-scale gravity model, perhaps it can contribute to collider signatures in that context. So in general, a motivation for this type of study of these more generic compactifications is that, at the very least in the early universe, with its high energy densities, we expect such things to be there, given that they're energetically allowed. And of course, inflation may dilute it. There may be many things that affect the later impact of this physics, but anyway, there are interesting questions like whether they can survive and decay late enough to produce signatures, maybe gravity wave signatures or something. And also, there, as usual again with tachyon problems, there's good reason to believe, just based on the structure of the tachyon interactions, that there should be topological defects. In this case, it's a complex mode, so that we would expect strings. So there could be topological defects of that sort that could play a role as well. So I'm finishing a little bit early, but let me stop and see if there are questions.
Final question. You have a proof that there's no remnant in this split, that there's no singularity or some naked singularity left over or anything like that?
Well, again, that would require a hugely IR attractive fixed point among these minimal model CFTs. And again, or said in the other direction I was explaining, it would require that it would require either that the supersymmetric Sine-Gordon mass gap is totally wrong, or that the resulting tachyons in the subcritical theory, again, can flow to some hugely attractive IR fixed point. This is, I don't think there's an absolute mathematical proof against this, but there's a huge amount of work on the RG flow in this system that strongly contraindicates it. I think actually in this linear sigma model, it may even translate into a more direct proof, where at least showing that there is a pathway to this. Another version of your question, which is a little bit milder, is there other pathways to other things? Could there be some by our stable fixed point that's, you know, somewhere else. Maybe you do have to tune to get in its basin of attraction, but it also exists. I mean, that would be fascinating, but given all this good stuff about the normalization flow of this sort of system, there's no evidence for that, and there's a huge amount of evidence going the other way. Yeah.
So a couple things. One is, first of all, so the time reverse process can presumably happen.
Well, that's like the space brain stuff where you can fine tune incredibly and then make the brain and anti-brain appear and then go. Okay, so yeah, but in that, at that level, there'd be something like that.
I mean, it's strictly a time turn it into way.
Yeah, but it's very finely tuned. Going the reverse way is very, very finely tuned.
There is a lot of entropy in the absolute.
Yeah.
So you have to prepare the states for it on both sides.
Yeah, but microscopically, yeah. It's just a question of the entropy.
Right.
So I suspect that, you know, it is basically the, I think the baby universe story in terms of coherence. It seems like it should be. You can have these things joined, you can have them split. So you have some distribution of them out there, joining and splitting all the time. And that those, in effect, couple to some operators. Theory sort of on our world, and that it has the effect of giving you a, at least from one perspective, a distribution for coupling constants for these operators. And then if you go to the right basis, then you discover that there isn't really loss of coherence.
That sounds very interesting. I do wonder, though, about the difference here, which seems to be that it's, well, okay, you can tell me if this is or isn't a difference, but here the process going one way. So in the early universe, we'd expect there to have been these things just because there's a thermal gas of high energy excitations in general. And then the decay is, you know, naturally goes in this direction that we discussed. Whereas the reverse process, while possible, is extremely special. So,
that's a question, I think, for just the boundary conditions you apply both to the dynamics in our geometry and to the ensemble of the baby universes.
Well, I mean, but some of the dynamics is evident. I mean, this is, I would like to talk more to you about it offline. It's just, I think it's rather, or whatever, we have time, we can talk about it.
Probably more than a 5-minute discussion.
Probably.
But your expectation is basically the whole thing cascades down until it splits into as many components as possible.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I should say one more thing, though, about the early, if we're talking about real scenarios. I mean, as I tried to emphasize early on, if you put more ingredients in, like fluxes and this and that, then you can easily metastabilize yourself away from these points. So, in an honest analysis of what's generic in the early universe, that can also be taken into account. And then what can happen is it takes some non-perturbative effects to get it going. So in that context, if you have such fluxes, they're not completely stable. They can decay by brain nucleation, at which point the flux gets weak enough that now this thing can happen, and then it goes. Another aspect of this is that some of the handles will have periodic boundary conditions, so some of it will survive, some of it will decay. You know, there's a rather large statistical problem to keep track of what's likely to emerge in the future. But yeah, I mean, the way you said it is indeed how we're thinking about it.
All this has to get flavored away.
Well, strings don't have to be terrible. I mean, what if this is happening in some warp throat, or, you know, I don't know.
Or in some danger of having the rain walls around it.
Well, here it's a complex tachyon, so I mean, all the moduli are naturally complex in this particular setup. But yeah, we would like to think about whether there are, you know, reasonable scenarios in which there would be a surviving signature. I mean, that would be, of course, fascinating. I mean, one reason to consider gravity waves is that this, I don't know if I have a drawing of it, but when the thing caps off, at that point, the string coupling is still weak, but the curvatures right there are obviously large, and so the thing, when it snaps back, could send out a good size gravity wave signal. Again, difficult to compute in complete detail, but one could estimate the scale.